Buddhist Summer School, Thursday morning, 7th September, 1978. It will be useful this morning to consider briefly the difference between ignorance and delusion. You know how ignorance holds a very important place in the teachings of the Buddha. That it is due to ignorance, avidya, Pali, avidya in Sanskrit. It is due to ignorance as the starting point that the whole cycle of evil comes into being. Now it is not uncommon to mix up ignorance, avidya, with delusion, moha. You see? So we'll spend just a few minutes considering that. How is avidya presented in the Theravada teachings? Sariputta, in the Sammāditthi Sutta, gives a very concise presentation of the meaning of avidya, ignorance. Not to know the truth of dukkha, the truth of its origin, the truth of its stopping, and the truth of the eightfold path to its stopping. That is avidya, ignorance. Note very carefully that these are, of course, the Four Noble Truths. They are the starting point of the whole of the teaching of the Buddha. Not to know these things, not to know that all this existential being, the whole of the becoming process, is dukkha. And we should always bear in mind carefully and see clearly the true meaning of the word dukkha. It is presented in the ordinary way as birth is dukkha, decay, old age, death, etc. Those things are dukkha. But those are all the secondary aspects of dukkha. Dukkha, fundamentally, for human beings, means the state of non-enlightenment, the imperfect state, the state in which one is not completely in tune, in communion with the totality. And this means that mind, which specifically distinguishes man, has not come to its fruition, its complete maturity, and its full and free functioning in this world whilst we are alive. I have often presented the meaning, which is derived from Buddha Ghosha's Visuddhimagga, that dukkha means the infinite ka. It's the Sanskrit sound, actually. Ka means the infinite, and du means that which spoils, or that which is which has broken away from, or which is bad. Of course, you can't say bad infinite. That's an absurdity, but you understand, therefore. It means that our mind, our state of consciousness, is far from the infinite. It is not in communion. That is its fundamental meaning. This is the great dukkha which drives the person who is beginning to awake, urges him on to tread the path and become free of all the limitations and all the evils which are consequent upon this state of dukkha. And not to know this is the root source of all the evil that mankind suffers and brings into being because of his ignorance. We ourselves bring it into being. It is true we are born ignorant, there is no getting away from that, but we persist in the ways of ignorance, which are the ways of evil. So all existential manifestation is in a state of dukkha. So these four noble truths, not to know them means dukkha. Next, not to know that everything has by nature an origin, everything that has by nature an origin has also by nature a cessation. It's important to notice the implication here. Everything that we with our sense functioning experience has by nature an origin, a beginning. There is a proceeding and then there is a dying. The implication is that there is that which has no origin, but it is. It has no origin, therefore it has no proceeding, no rolling on, as the Buddha puts it, and no cessation, no dying. The deathless state is there, you see. In other words, he was putting in negative terms what is put in positive terms in other religions. But there is, of course, that very definite positive affirmation of transcendence by the Buddha himself. There is, O monks, that unborn, unformed, unmade. And it is because of that, because it is there, it is possible for release from the dukkha of the born, the formed, the made, can be realized. So the positive is by inference, by implication. It is never stated as such in Buddhism to any great extent. And that is one of the indications of the superb psychological presentation about insight of the Buddha and the superb psychological efficiency of his presentation of the whole of the path. Because what we know here is not that unborn, unbecome, unmade. So it's no good trying to talk in positive terms about that which we do not know. Therefore, we put it in negative terms, because that we are acquainted with, that is our starting point. Everything that has by nature an origin has also by nature a cessation. If we really see that, what has been called the stainless vision of truth, if we really see that, then we will not imagine that, this is permanent, this is the real, the truth, and so forth. There is that discourse in which a visitor to the Buddha comes and declares that this, the body, is the whole thing, permanent, and so forth. There are two or three such discourses, in fact, with different people. And the Buddha listens to him and then talks and points out and makes him, the one who comes to visit him, makes the visitor himself say finally that no, this is not the permanent. This is anicca. Lastly, Sariputta points out in this sutta, which is called the Sammāditthi Sutta, not to know the true nature of things, summed up as, you know, the three signs of being, as they are called, anicca, anatta, and dukkha. Not to know that. And on account of not knowing that, we regard transient things as permanent, sometimes as absolute, as self-subsistent, and next, unreal things as real and desirable. In mentally and spiritually undeveloped beings, and we may, without using the word pejoratively, call them subhuman beings. We are still in the subhuman state. When we are truly enlightened, then we are in the fully human state. In mentally and spiritually undeveloped beings, governed by blind urges and subconscious drives, this avidya, this ignorance, leads to confusion, to hallucinations, to delusion. This is moha. And this broadly has two special aspects to it. The confusion in the mind, delusion in the mind, and stupidity in connection with action. Our actions are foolish. They are inefficient. They are destructive. They lead, in the course of time, to ill consequences. Sometimes the ill consequences are there immediately, and sometimes the ill consequences take a period of time to show themselves. So that is moha, delusion. Delusion in mind, and stupidity in action. A delusion also leads us, in fact drives us, helped by the drives born of natural evolution in our body. our bodies, the result of our evolution from some primordial animal ancestor. So we inherit these drives. And delusion leads us to satisfying our pleasure drive and delusion leads us to fear and to hatred and aversion. The pleasure drive, greed, raga, as it is called, includes all lusts, each and every one of them. The lust for possessions, the lust for power, the lust for sensational delights, for indulging all our senses, and so forth. Not right use of the senses, in which we fully enjoy in the right way that which legitimately should be enjoyed in the sensuous sphere for the sake of the health of the whole psychophysical organism, but the sheer indulgence born of delusion. This is where the stupidity comes in. You know the lovely, I think it's a Japanese saying, isn't it? First the man takes a drink, then the drink takes a drink, then the drink takes the man. Now, the mere intellectual assent by the brain as to the truth of anicca and anatta is insufficient. The brain's assent to the recognition that we suffer from separate, isolative egohood is insufficient. That is a superficial knowledge. It is not true knowledge. True knowledge, as Plato so beautifully pointed out in his day, is such that we can naturally put that into practice. It's like your expert artist. He has become the perfect artist and he can do the thing quite naturally and spontaneously. Your truly great performer, musical performer for instance, his performance is effortless. It just flows out of him like that with ease. He can naturally do it. Why? Because he truly knows it completely, with mind and body. Now, the live awareness, the living awareness, intense, thrilling consciousness of the truth is quite different. If it is there, then you are really awake. That is the meaning, one of the deep meanings of being awake. You are not merely on guard against sloth or sleepiness or the unawakened state, for that spells conflict, merely to be on guard against it. When really awake, the whole person is intensely active. Without the intrusion of the thought, I am awake, I am in action. It just happens. What does that imply? That the universal process, the whole universe, is manifesting fruition and fulfillment through you, the perfected instrument. Is manifesting in perfection. That is what it means. Then that I, the subject consciousness is out and there is true spontaneity, naturalness. When that is the case, there is quite simply, the fact of awakenedness of whole action. It is important to appreciate this difference between ignorance and delusion. Now, we have been dealing with the five bodhisattvas. We have only touched the fringe of it all. It has not been possible to go into any considerable exposition of it. And you see on the blackboard this little tabulation of what are called the five poisons in our life. And as the old people always put it, the antidote. Now the first, ignorance, avidya, and moha, delusion, are grouped together. And the realm of the gods, all the gods, the devas, the shining ones, from div, meaning to shine. See? All the devas who flourish in the realm of the devas are in a state of ignorance, of delusion. Everything is wonderful and happy for them, and they don't know it. Now, let's clear our minds of the idea of devas as immaterial beings who live in some wonderful immaterial sphere. The word deva, as the Buddha himself pointed out, means one who has attained excellence in any line. If you attain excellence as a poet, you shine, you stand out in the world as a shining light in that direction. If you are a great scientist, you are a shining light in that direction. If you are a king or a queen or whatever it is, or the first man who managed to reach the moon or something, you are someone who has attained and manifested an excellence. You are a deva. Let us confine ourselves to that understanding of the word deva. And you will find that the whole lot in that first column, they all refer to us and their worlds, as they are called, whether it be the heaven world of the devas or the hells of the evildoers, the ones with hate and so forth, they all refer to our own mind and consciousness. Hell is not located downstairs, or heaven up in the skies. It's here and now in us. They are all within the mind of man himself, within his psyche, within his own mind, his own consciousness. So if we look at it that way, we will see at once the very practical application of the teachings of Sila, Samadhi and Panya in relation to us human beings. And the antidote to that is Vairochana. We dealt with Vairochana. He is the illuminator, the radiant one, and he holds the Dharma Dhatu. That is, it is that aspect of our mind which is in tune with truth. And you see, it is rupa, form, shape, as it functions in us, which is transformed into the pure knowledge of things. That means that all forms and shapes in their transformation, in their perfection, represented by the Dhyanibuddha Vairochana, are the expressions, the exponents, therefore, the demonstrators of the supreme truth, the dharma, dhatu. Dhatu is stuff, substance, if you like, the very stuff of truth. Then come those in whom hatred is predominant, dvesha, and they live in hell. And the hell is here. And my goodness, don't they make hell for everybody else also, with their own hell. Now, when the disturbances, the raging on the surfaces of the ocean of consciousness, the alaya vijnana, when all that storm subsides, remember Jesus, peace be still, and the waves were stilled. Then that's represented by another aspect within ourselves, the Dhyanibuddha Akshobhya. And with the stilling of the waves, one has the mind manifests that mirror-like wisdom, the wisdom born of the utter stillness and silence within the mind. And therefore that mirror, now that the surface waves are stilled, shows the essential nature of things, the true nature of all things, reflected, all forms and shapes reflected in their pristine purity, the yatha bhutam. Bhutam is stuff, yatha as it actually is. You see, the true nature of things, that's represented by Akshobhya. Then with most humans, in fact we may say with all humans, until we are truly liberated from our ego conceit, from our pride, from our isolative self-consciousness, asmi mana. Asmi is I am, mana, the mind which feels and thinks in terms of I am myself, different from, separate from, better than, worse than, not so good as, far superior to you. You see, it's like that. And of course, now when that has been transformed, and that is concerned specifically with our feelings, and this is where the great Brahma Viharas come in. Then when the feeling and thought, all concerned with oneself, has undergone transformation, it becomes universal love, feeling and thought. You see. And therefore, metta, karuna, mudita and upekha are in full functioning. And Ratna Sambhava typifies, is the personification in terms of the Dhyanibuddha. The true lover of mankind, the true lover and server of humanity. That is that aspect, Ratna Sambhava. And therefore, there is the full awareness of the sameness of all beings. I put it in these terms myself. We say in life, in everyday life, oh, that man is my enemy. He's always up against me. This man is a very good friend of mine. He's one with me, and so forth. Well, that man may be inimical, this man may be friendly. But I cannot deny nature's fact that both men are my fellow human beings, like myself. They are only other versions of myself. You see? So there is this sameness of all beings in that sense. Then raga, greed, is the realm of hungry ghosts. We are the ghosts ourselves. There is another way in which we can understand the meaning of ghosts. We do not forget the past, primarily because we have not fully worked it out. You see, in relation to people, we'll confine ourselves to people because it is easier to see it that way. So they remain in our consciousness all the time. We think of them either with aversion or with attachment, either with praise or with censure, and quite often with a mixture of the two opposites. You see? Now, these are the ghosts. You know how, for instance, one comes across this particularly with certain film stars who make 5, 6, 7 and 25 marriages in succession in order to have the benefit of 5, 6, 7 and 25 alimonies, you see. And they are still married in their minds and hearts, perhaps just to one of their husbands, with whom they had, at least to some degree and for some little time, a true relationship of love, in which they were able to give themselves wholeheartedly, and they never forget that person. They are married to a ghost, plus the next fellow from whom they'll get alimony. So they are they are one class of the hungry ghosts, the pretas, and they don't have a special location in space. They are there within the mind. All this is within one's own mind. And when greed undergoes its full transformation, then it is represented by the Dhyani Buddha Amitabha, the discriminating vision. Also, there is that superior aspect. There's not merely raga involved, but the perceptions. That is what we actually dealt with, you remember, during this week. That the perceptions which we have in their transformation become the discriminating vision in their, when one has freed oneself from avidya. Then we have that element of irsha, envy. Envy which sets us up against somebody else. We are always, they are the asuras, always quarreling, always fighting. They are the sort of people who, whatever you say to them, say, "Oh, I don't agree with you." A good many intellectuals are guilty of this. A dear friend of mine, who is a very brilliant man in intellectual in Canada, he actually is a senator and so forth, and he's a delightful man, and with a lovely sense of humor. And one of his friends in Canada is a lady who is practically stone deaf, but you know, with that sort of sharp acidic brain. And she was present at one of the lectures he gave, and she came up and said, "Oh, that was a marvelous lecture. I don't agree with a word of what you said." How on earth the deaf lady can agree or disagree, to me, is a mystery. But there it is. That's a fairly harmless type of asura ship, you see. But there we are. Now, they, in their transformation, ultimate transformation, are represented by Amogha Siddhi, the all-accomplishing, the one who knows that what is done now is perfectly done. And Metta and Karuna are characteristics of Amogha Siddhi as such. Then the animal world, now this refers actually to the animal world as such. They suffer from avidya due to their less developed consciousness and lack of intellectual faculties. There is no sort of depreciation or condemnation of them. They are good animals, but they live without the power of choice as to what path they will take. Animals cannot help manifesting what they do manifest. That is their nature, that's how nature has made them, and they react accordingly, in tune with how nature has made them. So there is no such thing as a bad animal or an evil animal or a good animal. Some animals can be trained and they can be very, very useful and helpful and so forth. But it would be a mistake to think of any animal as an evil thing, just as much as it would be a mistake to think of an animal as the perfect good in our sense of the word good, because they have no power to look within and know themselves. You can say, "Man, know thyself." You can't say to an animal, "Dear elephant," or "Dear skunk, know thyself." We can't do it. Now, again, let it be repeated, don't regard the Dhyani Buddhas and what they stand for as antidotes to these five poisons in our life: avidya, moha, hatred, ego conceit, greed, envy. Not as antidotes. But if you allow, through perfect mindfulness, the transformation to take place naturally, then the fruit of it is represented by the functioning of the Dhyani Buddhas. All those Dhyani Buddhas represent the different emphases laid by the perfect mind upon its own mental life. Anything like an antidote or a counteraction is only helps the state of conflict. So now, going through this, we may sum up somewhat along these lines. First, I should just like to point out Amoga Siddhi represents fearlessness. One of the final elements which goes. They say spiritual pride is the last to go. That is also true. Perhaps pride goes with the emergence of perfect fearlessness. The fundamental fear of the entire living world, the entire living world, is the fear of death. Our whole living process, whether it be the natural unconscious process, more or less subconscious process of the animal world, or whether it be ourselves, our concern is self-preservation against what we misconceive as a hostile universe. The world is trying to crush us out of existence, you see, and we are on guard against it. We are afraid of the ending of this which we call ourselves, our ego conceit, and our incorrigible clinging to the mistaken idea of an I am I, thrown out by Manovijnana. I am I, an immortal entity which persists through time unchanged. That is quite impossible. No entity can ever be immortal. That is why the Buddha completely rejected all ideas of a god or a set of gods who are identifiable entities forever and ever. They come into being, they proceed, they disappear. Now, with regard to this thing, fearlessness, centuries before the birth of the Buddha, in the Atharva Veda, they knew all these things and they put it in their form. And it's very interesting to find that in the 10th book, the 8th hymn, the last verse, this is, I'll read the last two verses. They stated, men versed in sacred knowledge, knowing that living power that abides in the nine-petaled lotus flower, which is the body, enclosed with triple bands and bonds, desireless, firm and immortal, self-existent, contented with the essence, lacking nothing, free from the fear of death, is he who knoweth that Atma, the ultimate reality, courageous, youthful, undecaying. That's in the Atharva Veda. Now, the mantra, as it is called, the Om Mani Padme Hum. The Om represents the way of universality, Vairochana, the Dharma Dhatu wisdom. Mani represents the equality of all beings and unity. Equality not in the lifeless mathematical sense, but that word includes the uniqueness of each individual also. That is Ratna Sambhava. Padme is Amitabha, the unfolding vision, the lotus Padma opening out, who represents integration. Akshobhya, of course, embodies the reflective clarity of a perfectly stilled consciousness, the wisdom of the great mirror. Ratnasambhava, the solidarity of all beings. Amitabha, the inner vision through which the illusory nature of I and world is revealed. Because when there is love in its fullness, there is no separation between self and not self, between you and me, between I and the world. There is only complete unity. Amoghasiddhi converts all these experiences and their resulting knowledge into perfect action, making the adept into an enlightened one, the perfectly enlightened Buddha, Samyak Sambuddha.